ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 16th of January. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Reports are suggesting the US President Donald Trump is cooling on the idea of launching attacks on Iran, despite earlier promising protesters help is on the way. The demonstrations have rattled the hardline Islamic regime for more than a fortnight, but the US leader says he's been told the killings have stopped. The protests have been met with a violent crackdown from the government, with a US-based human rights group verifying at least 2,500 deaths, but others claim the number is much higher. Bridget Rollison reports from Jerusalem.
In Tehran, the human cost of unrest is impossible to ignore. Rows of black body bags lining the streets have become a grim but common sight in Iran's capital after days of bloodshed. The person taking this video saying the deaths are in the name of the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. A week-long internet blackout has made it difficult to get information from inside Iran. But journalists that work there have been speaking to people on the streets about a possible US military intervention after thousands of protesters were killed rallying against the regime.
I think the possibility of Trump attacking Iran is high because he's not mentally stable and most of the advisors he has are Jewish lobbyists.
We gave them a firm response last time. I don't think they dare to attack again.
But after threatening to intervene, Donald Trump now says he's been given assurances that the killing of protesters will stop, instead adopting a wait-and-see approach. Despite saying there'll be no more executions, the regime is continuing to publicly shame those it has in custody, airing interrogations on state television. According to news agency AFP, it was a trio of Gulf countries that talked Donald Trump out of an attack. Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Oman reportedly led frantic diplomatic discussions convincing the president that a military strike would have grave blowbacks in the region. Even some NATO allies are urging restraint from the US. Turkey's Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan also telling the US to avoid military action in Iran, despite close ties between both countries' presidents.
We are against a military intervention in Iran. Iran needs to resolve its own problems. Our priority is to avoid any situation that would lead to the use of force. We are absolutely in favour of dialogue.
It's a call that's been echoed by some Kurdish Iranians from the north of the country who fled the chaos into Turkey.
Iran is beautiful. We don't want Trump to start a war. There is chaos in Iran. There is war in Iran. It has stopped now, but it is unclear what will happen. President Trump said he would intervene in Iran, but he can't.
As the world waits to see what Donald Trump will do, Iranian airspace has reopened, and some US military personnel are reportedly returning to bases in the region. If the president doesn't intervene, it could be seen as abandoning the protesters he promised to send help and urged to keep rallying at enormous personal risk. But Donald Trump often relies on unpredictability to keep his opponents guessing. This is Bridget Rollison in Jerusalem, reporting for AM.
Patrick Clawson is from the Washington Institute, where he directs the program on Iran and US policy. He joined me for more on this story. Patrick, thank you very much for joining us on AM today. Earlier in the week, it looked like President Trump was preparing to take action. Do you think he really has been talked out of it?
Well, at least for the moment, yes, in that he has convinced himself that the killings are over because of the threats that he issued, and that for him is victory, and so that's good enough for him.
Do you think this change of mind will have a major impact for ordinary Iranians when earlier in the week he was promising help is on the way, go out on the streets?
Well, frankly, by the time he made those promises, the mass killings by the Iranian authorities had already persuaded most Iranians that it was a unwise idea to go out in the streets. And so I think the question is whether or not, had the U.S. intervened, the Iranians would have returned to the streets. And the answer to that is entirely unclear. But we don't know it. But we aren't going to know that.
And Patrick, you said it looks like he has changed his mind for the moment. What do you think might bring him back to the table, looking at options again?
It's entirely conceivable that the hardliners in Iran will say, okay, now's the time for us to have another round of crackdown, so this time on the leaders and on the people who we find to be guilty for their involvement in the protests, and we start seeing substantial killings. And since Trump has very moved by pictures, he could be moved by pictures of renewed killings in Iran.
Mm. And do you have a sense of what military options might have been on the table earlier in the week, or if this does escalate again, what the U.S. might be considering?
Well, Mr. Trump's preference is for one-and-done kinds of military actions. That is to say, he doesn't like sustained campaigns. So I think that his preference would have been for something which can look kind of spectacular, but isn't going to lead to a sustained campaign. That's a tough one to come up with here, because the kinds of actions that are most likely to have an impact are, in fact, cyber actions, for which you can't claim credit. And that's not how Mr. Trump likes to do things.
And when you say looks kind of spectacular, do you mean something like missiles or airstrikes, something that has a high visual impact?
That would be one way of doing it. I'm sure that the Pentagon people are trying to come up with some more creative way of doing things, but that will be a challenge. What we saw in the beginning of the 12-day war between Israel and Iran was that with exquisite intelligence, it was possible for the Israelis to do a whole lot that first night. If the United States had anything like that kind of intelligence, then it might be able to carry out some kind of an action. But I don't see indications that the U.S. has that sort of intelligence.
And Patrick, just how difficult would it be for the U.S. to topple this regime?
Toppling a regime is the kind of thing that's so hard to predict because regimes like this look like they're rock solid until they fall, the way Assad fell so quickly in Syria. It would appear that this regime is much more solid than Assad's, that it's been spending a lot of time ideologically vetting the people who are out there in their repressive apparatus, and that those people are more committed to this regime than was the case of Assad's people. But the proof will be in when an occasion rises, they have to do things. What we saw the other night was that they were quite prepared to kill large numbers of people without any qualms.
And what do you think the U.S.'s end game is when it comes to Iran?
The U.S. wants to see the Iranians end their nuclear program, reduce their missile threat, and not sponsor destabilizing activities such as terrorism abroad. If Iran were to liberalize, democratize, wonderful. But frankly, that's not as important to the United States as ending the external threats from Iran.
So, Patrick, you're suggesting perhaps tensions have cooled for now, but not over for good.
Well put.
Patrick Clawson, the director of the Iran program at the Washington Institute, thanks very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thank you.
The federal government's proposed changes to hate speech and gun laws hang in the balance just days out from it being introduced to Parliament. The Greens say they won't support the legislation without significant amendments, while the opposition leader has signalled the Liberals won't back the bill. Political reporter Romy Stevens filed this story.
Labor's proposed laws to combat anti-Semitism and extremism are facing a lot of pushback, but Race Discrimination Commissioner Giridharan Sivaraman is hopeful they'll help make a difference.
The Jewish community has a human right to be safe. The Bondi terror attack has shattered that right or that capacity. So we do need action, and this is one of the mechanisms that can help.
The federal government hopes to pass sweeping changes to hate speech and gun laws when Parliament returns for 2 days next week. week. It can cut a deal with either the opposition or the Greens, but both say they won't support the bill as it stands. The Greens argue a new offence that would make it illegal to incite or promote racial hatred should be broadened to protect all minority groups. Giridharan Sivaraman agrees.
None of us is safe unless all of us are safe. And if we protect some community against hate crimes but not others, then hate will continue to flow.
Labor has flagged it's open to amendments as well as extending protections to other minority groups in the future. However, consensus with the coalition is looking less likely after opposition leader Susan Lee labelled the laws unsalvageable. Some coalition members have raised concerns about the impact the legislation could have on free speech. Associate Professor at Griffith University's School of Criminology, Kieran Hardy, says the laws, if passed, could have a chilling effect.
We'll have to see down the track how these laws play out, but I think that's quite possible that we might see people feeling less able to say what they want to freely. And that's not in any way to allow or excuse or accept dangerous speech, highly offensive speech, but I just think that we need to get this right before it's put into the law.
One of the controversial aspects within the legislation is that directly quoting from a religious text for the purpose of teaching or discussion may provide a defence to the new racial hatred offence. Kieran Hardy says that exemption comes with challenges.
We might see groups putting their beliefs down into religious text to try and claim some defence. Now, we'd have to see how that would play out in a court. A court may say, well, that's not a religious text. We're only including sort of the mainstream religions. But there's no clarity on that in the legislation.
Luke McNamara is a professor in the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. He says the religious text exemption does more harm than good.
It kind of sets up a priority order that suggests that people of faith are entitled to a more expansive idea of free speech than others who are not people of faith. And so that's a problem because it suggests an unevenness in the potential application of this law.
Luke McNamara is among many experts who are concerned about how quickly the government wants to pass such complex legislation.
Changes of this magnitude should never be made in haste. I understand the environment that has been created by the tragic events in Bondi, but that doesn't make for a good contemplative lawmaking environment.
Labor will introduce the bill to Parliament during a special two-day sitting next week.
Romy Stevens reporting. The federal government says 4.7 million accounts have been deactivated in the first month of its teen social media ban. The ban rolled out in early December, blocking those under the age of 16 from their accounts on platforms including Facebook, Snapchat and Instagram. Australia is the first country to try this approach, and many other nations around the world are watching closely. Angus Randall reports.
When her family moved from Victoria to the rural town of Chinchilla in southern Queensland 2 years ago, Dusty Rose Eiley kept in touch with her friends on Facebook and Instagram.
2 days before the ban came in place, I was kicked off the platforms pretty much instantly. It sucked a lot because it's just like some people from Vic that I was friends with, I don't have them on anything else, so there's no way for me to contact them.
Her mum, Amanda Ryan, says all of her children are struggling to find alternative ways to maintain long-distance friendships.
It has caused a lot of stresses. Just it's hard to get phone numbers and stuff for people.
Dusty Rose Eiley was able to bypass Snapchat's verification.
I just scrunched up my face and it like didn't ask any questions or anything afterwards.
And she's not the only one. Sydney dad Brian Hancock is disappointed his 14-year-old son remains on social media.
My son became addicted to social media almost from the first time he used it. And I was really hoping that the social media ban would actually, you know, block him. He just did the facial ID and that came up and said he was 16 plus. That was it.
Dr. Timothy Koski from the University of Sydney says the ability to bypass the ban is not necessarily a sign of its flaws.
This is a gradually tightening ring that's not going to leave people completely out of pocket in some cases or really isolated and these sorts of things. If a parent is desperate to get their kid on social media and they've managed to do so, I don't count that as a loss.
Meta says it's removed nearly 550,000 accounts so far. It's calling on the government to find an alternative beyond blanket bans. In a statement, Minister for Communications Annika Wells says the figures are a huge achievement, and the eSafety Commissioner is looking closely at the data to determine what it shows in terms of individual platforms' compliance. So what does the future look like for the social media ban? Dr. Koski says teenagers' behaviour will become a lot clearer once they're back at school, and it's hard to know whether they'll shift to alternative platforms.
4chan is a big one. They've been around for decades, and kids haven't found them fun enough to get on. So I think maybe it could be a bit too early to say whether or not they'll lower their standards to go somewhere else.
The world is watching. The UK, France, and Denmark are among several European nations considering a similar ban. Dr. Koski says the Australian policy has passed a major test, allowing other places to follow.
The worst case scenario, especially for the Australian context and then how that extends elsewhere, is if there was an embarrassing moment, right? Some kind of a scandal, some kind of a big backlash, and it hasn't landed. It hasn't hit. So any country that wants to look like they're doing something, this is a great option for them. It's going to be very attractive.
Dr. Timothy Koski from the University of Sydney, ending that report from Angus Randall and Annie Guest. Millions of Australians are currently taking antidepressants, but a major study has found the most common type might not be effective for around 20% of people. In one of the largest studies of its kind, Sydney University researchers found this cohort of people had an atypical subtype of depression, where symptoms like weight gain and oversleeping are different from the usual experiences of the condition. National Health reporter Stephanie Dalzell has the story.
At times struggling to leave her house, Alexis Hutchin was consumed by a severe depressive episode about 5 years ago. She was prescribed common antidepressants, but despite trying them for more than a year, they didn't help.
When you think back, it seems like a really short time for a year just, you know, trying different treatments. But when you're seriously depressed, I'm sure lots of people would agree with me, it feels like forever. It feels like you're constantly failing, that you'll never get better, because I guess these are the standard treatments being, you know, advertised. They're not working for you.
Researchers from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre examined nearly 15,000 Australians with depression and found about 20% had an atypical type. The report's senior clinical lead, Ian Hickey, says atypical depression more commonly affects women and presents differently.
People with typical depression tend to have disrupted sleep and lose their appetite and lose weight. By contrast, people with atypical depression tend to oversleep and gain weight. Most clinical guidelines largely ignore the concept of atypical depression and don't recognise there's a really fundamental difference here.
Those clinical guidelines recommend common antidepressants known as SSRIs as a first-line treatment for depression. SSRIs and similar medications target neurotransmitters like serotonin in the brain. But the researchers found those with atypical depression were less likely to benefit from them and more likely to experience side effects from those medications like weight gain and drowsiness. Report lead author Miriam Shin says the research sends a clear message. Standard antidepressants shouldn't be the only line of defence for everyone.
Depression is not a single illness, it's a heterogeneous. So we need to carefully monitor the individual symptoms and their other health conditions.
Head of psychiatry at the University of Melbourne, Chris Davey, who wasn't involved in the study, says while antidepressants can still be helpful for people with depression, other treatments should be used as well.
Sleep and exercise and diet and alcohol consumption are really important factors. Psychotherapy is a really useful treatment. Medication can complement that, but I think it's too often the only treatment people are getting.
Alexis Hutchin ultimately found a combination of treatments that worked for her, and the 35-year-old now draws on her own experience while working as a youth mental health researcher at the Brain and Mind Centre.
What this research really highlights is that depression, you know, isn't one single experience and it doesn't look the same for everybody. I think, you know, diagnosing and treating depression often relies on broad categories and standard pathways, but not everyone fits neatly into those boxes. So I think this research sort of shifts that thinking away from one size fits all model and towards more personalised care.
Youth mental health researcher Alexis Hutchin ending that report by Stephanie Dalzell and Paige Coburn. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. With the extraordinary start to 2026, which has included the capture of the Venezuelan president and a threat to take over Greenland, there's a renewed focus on the US president's right-hand man, Stephen Miller. Today's staff writer for The Atlantic, Ashley Parker, on her investigation into Trump's deputy chief of staff, his power and growing influence. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.